brought to you by ConcordiaTheology.org, bringing you resources that support the vigorous life of the mind in service of the gospel of Christ.
Welcome to Lectionary Kickstart. We're sparking your thoughts for Sunday as you plan your sermon or teaching lesson. I'm your host and producer, Jessica Bordolo, here with Dr. David Schmidt and Dr. Peter Nafsker. They're both professors of homiletics here at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. You can hear all about us in our introductory episode, but trust me, they are pretty good preachers. All right, let's get started. David, where are we in the church year?
The 25th Sunday after Pentecost, a time when the church continues to celebrate the Holy Spirit and the Spirit's work in the world.
And Peter, what are the texts this week?
The texts are taken from 1 Kings 17, Hebrews 9, Mark 12, and Psalm 146.
As always, I ask each of you to tell me which text you would choose to preach about. To determine who goes first, and our Old Testament reading for today includes the story of the widow who was blessed with the jar of flour and oil that never would run out. So if there was one type of food in your house that would never run out, what would it be?
Peanut butter.
Right there.
That's so true.
I know.
Yeah. A jar of peanut butter that is never empty.
Oh, that would be great. Man.
See, no, I would say apple butter because I love apple butter.
Nice.
But it goes with peanut butter, so.
Okay.
Wow.
You say so.
See, now how do I pick? Because I was going to say perfectly ripe bananas because they're only perfectly ripe for 30 seconds and then they're old. So
yeah, that would be good.
That would be amazing. Peanut butter goes best with bananas. So, David, you win. You get
okay.
to go first.
Thank you. I think I would go with the gospel reading from Mark 12. This is just one of my favorite texts. I don't know why. I just I have sympathy for this poor widow, and I just love the fact that Jesus observes her. He doesn't talk to her. He doesn't intervene. He doesn't tell her anything. She doesn't learn anything at all, but he's trying to help others see her, and I just think that's it's profound for me that Jesus would direct his disciples' attention to see this woman.
And they need to be directed because they don't see her.
They don't see her at all.
They see the fancy stones, the big stones later.
Yeah.
And they see the stuff with the Pharisees.
Right.
But they don't notice apart from Jesus directing them.
Saying, look at this. So there's a lot of action going on, right? So you've got beforehand, before the widow appears, you've got the Pharisees, you've got the religious leaders, you've got their long prayers and the robes that they're wearing. You've got all of that going on. And then right after, as you say, and that's, I think if I would, I might actually include chapter 13,
yes,
verse 1.
Yes, I would.
You would?
Yeah,
I would too, because it's the disciples talking about how beautiful the temple is with all of these stones, right? And so it's kind of like they just didn't get it. Right?
Yeah, totally missed it.
Yeah, so you got people before and after who are not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the center, Jesus is asking them to turn their attention to this woman and see her. So, Jessica, why don't you, if you can, could you read chapter 13, verse 1? Because this is the disciples not getting it.
And as he came out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, what wonderful stones and what wonderful buildings."
Yeah, so you've got this adoration of the beauty of the temple afterwards.
Yeah.
And beforehand, you have kind of a display of the religious leaders that some people would find beautiful, but Mark lets us see how corrupt it is.
Well, and these are both worth noticing. I mean, the Pharisees were kind of prominent, and they were kind of the people who were running things. And the stones really were incredibly huge, beautiful. I mean, read some of Josephus about the gold-plated stones. I mean, this is incredible.
Right.
This is it's not so far off base that they would focus on those things.
Right. Yeah. And so in the midst of all of this beauty and corruption, Jesus is turning our attention to the woman. And I think a question that you have as a preacher is, why does Jesus want us to see her, right? Why is he asking us to see her? And unfortunately, I think a lot of people read this as a stewardship message.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want us to see her because she gives.
Right.
And I don't think that's at all what we're supposed to be seeing. But I mean, I think it can be interpreted that way.
So, well, it would be a strange lesson. This is the last time he's in the temple before he dies. He walks out the temple, and that's it before his crucifixion. And so it would be a little odd to have a kind of a little stewardship lesson.
A little stewardship lesson.
Right as he's leaving his father's house sleeping. For the last time.
Right, right. So, Jessica, read verse 43.
And he called his disciples to him and said to them, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing in the offering box."
Okay, so Jesus highlights that these two pennies from the widow are more than the abundance that other people have given. And I guess somebody could take that and they could look at it and say, and this is an encouragement to, you know, keep on giving. Let's have a, you know, give all you have campaign.
<You know>? Good luck with that.
I know. And, you know, let's just keep taking it. But I think if you read the description of the temple beforehand, and you have the description afterwards, so you see how it's sandwiched between these two descriptions. Mm-hmm. The description afterwards is the disciples' adoration of the physical building, and before we have a description of the people that are in the temple. Jessica, if you could read 38 through 40.
And in his teaching, he said, "Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes and like greetings in the marketplaces and have the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers, they will receive the greater condemnation."
That line, "they devour widows' houses." Hmm. And now you have a widow who is giving all she has. And if you think about it that way, all of the sudden this widow becomes an image of Christ, who is giving everything he has for a church that would devour him. Right? I mean, so these Pharisees and these religious leaders are mistreating the widows, devouring their houses. And this widow is, so one could say the church is corrupt, right? The church is corrupt. This widow comes and she gives everything she has to a church that is corrupt. That is the last thing you would want to be doing. You would want to stop her from giving those two things and say, "Don't give those to this church. Look how corrupt it is." Yeah. These people are pretentious. They're walking around with their long prayers. They're not speaking to God. They're speaking so everyone else can hear them. And they're going to take all the money that widows have and they're going to spend it on themselves or whatever. And, you know, and so it would be a warning. Don't give to that church. And yet you have a widow who is sacrificing herself for the sake of a corrupt church. And who else does that? Well, Jesus does. He sacrifices himself for a church that is corrupt because Christ has come to save the lost, not to condemn them, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's where the location of this, sometimes when it's treated as a stewardship text, it's taken completely out of context.
Right.
But this really is right before Jesus goes and gives everything he has.
Everything he has.
And you do wonder, you know.
For a church that is corrupt.
For a church
that is killing him.
For the people that are his own people who are rejecting him. He's giving everything.
Right. And so then it's kind of like this moment when Jesus is asking the disciples, you know, when you're looking for the church, don't look for huge stones. Don't look for the people who are in positions of power and who are calling attention to themselves. Look for the people who are sacrificing everything for people who don't deserve it. And there you're going to find. There you're going to find God at work in the lives of people. And so for me, I would kind of want to think of examples of people who are giving everything for the sake of others who don't deserve it, right? I mean, John Donne has this poem called The Cross, which is really, it's kind of fun. It's a long poem, but he just talks about, you know, how having experienced the cross, you begin to see it everywhere. And he's like, you know, you look down, you see, you know, if you're swimming, your body becomes a cross. You look up in the sky, you see birds and their wings and bodies look like crosses. When you look at ships, the mast and the yard, they look like a cross. I mean, he's just, all of a sudden he sees crosses everywhere. And so in a sense, I think Jesus is calling our attention to see this widow because he's giving us a foretaste of the love of God that's going to be present as all of his disciples bear their crosses in many different places and many different ways. What's more beautiful than the stones, what's more praiseworthy than these people is God who sends his son to give his life for a corrupt church and then for all of the people that he brings in who spend their lives giving all for those who don't deserve it. That would be kind of what I would think of or preach on as I look at this text.
I appreciated what you said about the stones and what they looked like because I would have had no idea what the stones in the
Temple some of them were like 6 feet.
No, they're bigger than that.
Okay, I mean, 11 feet?
Look, and Josephus, Josephus has some details about it, but they're plated in gold. They're like 30 feet deep and like 70 feet wide and 15 feet high. I mean, these are just, these are like railroad car sized stones. And with the, this is toward the end of the day probably, and the sun is down on the horizon glimmering off the gold plate. I mean, it would have been amazing. And that's the kind of stuff that attracts our attention, right?
Right.
The big stuff and not the little.
Yeah.
Now that's really helpful. And it sheds some light on the living stones verse where God is building us into a building full of living stones.
Oh, yeah.
That's really helpful. Peter, what about you? What would you preach on?
I think I would preach on the Old Testament text from 1 Kings 17.
And that's a fun one.
I love this text for a very personal reason. And that is when I was preaching every Sunday, the image that came to mind was the widow of Zarephath. I always felt like the women of Zarephath, the widow of Zarephath, because I felt like Sunday would roll along and I've got barely just enough flour and oil for one more sermon and I was going to preach it and then I was going to die. And you know how that is. You get just kind of you feel like you're kind of at the end of the rope and you just I've got nothing else left. And yet God promised through the prophet Elijah that there'll be enough next week too.
Yeah.
And so I kind of took comfort in this. Of course, I wouldn't preach that. But so I've always really liked this text, and it's such an image of it's an image of both desperation and an image of provision, okay?
Or and discovery.
Maybe discovery. Provision. Discovery. I hadn't thought through kind of how I alliterate that. But here's what I would kind of the general theme. So I was looking just in the Lutheran Study Bible has, you know, little paragraphs about some of these texts. And it says this text is about the never-ending goodness of God. He blesses us far beyond what we need or deserve. And that's true. But I wouldn't want to go too quickly to the divine provision that God provides here.
You want to experience the desperation.
I want to experience the desperation.
Yeah, right.
And so whatever you call it, the first kind of thought I had was kind of like living on the edge, but I might use the word desperation somehow, kind of a desperate times, desperate measures, something along those lines. And just I would maybe use kind of a multiple story structure here to look at the people who are in times of desperation in this text. So the first group would be God's people, this is the 9th century B.C. This is a century after the death of Solomon and the division of the kingdom. I mean, just look back the previous couple chapters in 1 Kings that it's this guy reigned and then this guy reigned and then this guy reigned and then this guy reigned and half of them were killing each other. I mean, the people of God were an absolute mess. They were so far from the glory days of David and his faithfulness. And so you have the people of God are if you're among the people of God looking at what your kings are doing, the wickedness, the unfaithfulness, these were desperate times.
And wasn't there a drought going on?
Well, this is where King Ahab was the king.
Yeah.
And you know, this is 1 Kings 16:33. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. And so God sends Elijah before this text, go tell Ahab, because of all his Baal worship and everything, there's going to be a famine.
Okay.
And God's judgment is coming. And so the first desperation is you've got the unfaithfulness of the leaders of Israel, and by extension, all of Israel. And because of that, they're bringing famine on themselves. Okay. Then you've got the desperation.
So not only do you have to deal with the kings, but now you got to deal with God.
Right. 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 Yeah, I mean, this is these are desperate times. Then you've got Elijah. God calls Elijah to go. This is the entrance of Elijah into the biblical narrative is 1 Kings 17, verse 1. Very first time he's mentioned. And God sends him and just says, you know, he's the Tishbite, and now go tell Ahab there's a famine coming. And you remember what happened after he told him that? Then he has to run away, and he goes out into the wilderness, and he is fed by the ravens, and he drinks out of the brook. Mm-hmm. But, of course, a famine means brook's going to dry up. And so he's out there hiding. So desperate times, I don't know what it would look like to get meat and bread from ravens.
I know, man.
But talk about desperate.
Wow.
And so Elijah himself is in this place of desperation when he then goes to, God says to him, arise, go to Zarephath, to this widow. So then you think about the widow. She has nothing, and she literally is on her last scrap of flour. And I was thinking about this, you know, the desperation of knowing, I mean, you don't have a market nearby, you don't have money. This is her last meal.
For
her and her child.
Right, yeah.
And then I'm going to die.
Right.
I mean, I felt desperate as a pastor, as a preacher sometimes, but I knew I'd struggle to preach a sermon the next Sunday, but I wasn't going to die with my family, with what was left of my family.
Right.
And so you've got this, you've got another person in desperation. And then I think I would invite my hearers to say, you know, what about the desperation we experience here today? Okay, it's not the same as the widow. Most of our congregations are not suffering through famine. But the desperation of a culture and a nation that just seems to be going further and further away from God, kind of the moral decay, the marginalization of the church, the shrinking of the church. That's kind of the people of God, kind of corporate. But then you think about the desperation that I think a lot of Christians feel, that in this time when things are going poorly on a big scale, there's the way in which each of us kind of live in our own little desperate context. And that, you know, kind of an image of people who are feeling, you know, whether it be your family's not what you dreamed it would be and it's just kind of not getting any better, or your career is kind of rolling down the tubes.
Well, for me, when I get desperate, I want to control something. That's what I want to do. I mean, I don't care how small it is. I want to have something that I can control.
Because
I can't deal with it being out of control.
So we kind of mask our desperation sometimes, or we kind of try to get away from it by controlling something or by just kind of pushing it aside, or maybe we think there's something wrong with us or something along these lines. Life is just oftentimes a disappointment. And there's no promise from God that necessarily things are always going to get a whole lot better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you have to be really careful about what you promise in times like this. This desperation, this is where I would then move to kind of a fourth story. If I've got the people of God, or even a fifth, the people of God, Elijah, the widow, your people. And then I would think about proclaiming Jesus in terms of one who himself went to the edge and went over it. How the desperation of being completely abandoned, completely rejected, the desperation of death on the cross. You know, that's about as bad as it can get. And that would be kind of help people see Jesus as one who does that for us. And then the promise then is the resurrection, that you have this, God has seen the desperation of his people, and he has raised Jesus from the dead, and he has promised resurrection. That's a promise you can proclaim.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes, what my concern is, sometimes there's family situations where there's no good solution on this side of heaven. There will be no kind of great turn, and now everything's happily ever after.
Right. If you're having desperation over a family member suffering from dementia,
right.
There's no magic pill that's going to happen.
Right.
And it's, yeah.
And so you have to kind of, I think, name that and recognize this is the situation that we all find ourselves in. And yet God raised him from the dead. And now I don't know if I would include this in the sermon, so I'd have to think about it a little bit more. But, you know, in First Kings 18, that's when the son of the widow actually dies.
Oh, that is the most powerful text.
And then Elijah comes and, you know, raises him from the dead.
Right.
And so I don't know if a sermon here could bring that in to proclaim the resurrection in some way or to point toward it. And so I'd probably be a little hesitant to do that.
If I remember correctly, I think the three-year lectionary each year has one of these Elijah stories. So I would think that this year, I mean, I'd look in the lectionary, but I would think that that's not going to appear in 2 weeks or something like that. And so bringing it in might be helpful, right?
Right. Yeah, so you maybe expand it a little bit. But the bottom line is, you know, that's not the end of the Christian story of desperation, because the Father has risen Jesus from the dead, and he has promised to raise us as well. And that actually then I think I would try to, again, maybe this is too much for a sermon, but I'm also noticing how God provided for people who are in desperation through people who are also in desperation.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got God provides for Elijah through the widow who herself has nothing.
Right.
And start to think about a people.
And who herself does not see herself as worshiping this God.
Well, I mean, that's a question you got to look
into.
That's
amazing. Well, I mean, she says, as the Lord your God lives.
Yeah.
Not my God.
That's what I would want to look up when I do my study on this text. I'd want to look at those kind of things, because I just came across something really briefly that suggested she was
an
Israelite outside of Israel.
Huh.
But I didn't do
enough. See, I kind of see her like Ruth, right? Who is, this is not her God, and yet she ends up following him.
Yeah, maybe right? So.
And so, but I don't know. But it's just kind of, you know, it's God's commanded a widow there to feed you.
Yeah, this is a great example in this podcast of
right.
We're having initial impressions that will feed our study of the text.
That's right.
And
that's
these
what,
are the
have
kind of
to
things
do the work.
You got to do the work.
But at least you're coming up with the questions,
right.
And then
right.
And if it turns out wrong, you kind of say, you know, when you read this, sometimes you might think.
Right, right. But she's even in a worse spot than we thought.
Yeah, you know? But I always thought that it was that in this scene, it's she's not of Israel. And so she's kind of like, as the Lord your God lives. But it's weird that God's commanding a widow.
Yeah, it may be. It's just something I saw that pointed that direction. But that's something to look up. But I like how this this whole story, if you kind of back away from it a little bit, is you've got God providing for people who are in desperation through people who are also in desperation.
Oh,
and so
nice.
You can kind of lead your hearers then toward this
which
life.
Which is what God did with Christ. They took Christ was in desperation.
And he provides for those who are in desperation through him.
Right.
And so I think there could be a nice way to lead your hearers into a kind of a, what do you do with your desperation? Well, God kind of promises us the end of it. And in the meantime, we look around at the people who are desperate too, and we share that.
It's kind of like desperate times call for desperate measures, and instead we have desperate times call for a desperate Savior.
Oh, there you go. Hey, that's not bad. There you go.
You know, that you know, and so you could kind of play with how desperate times call for desperate measures. People justify their actions because, well, it's a desperate time, and I've got to do this, and I've got to do that. And no, desperate times call for a desperate Savior.
Yeah.
And so we turn and see what God is doing.
Oh, that's I like that. Yeah, that's good.
That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Just to play on a
set. Right.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. That's all for today. We have free resources to guide your next step in planning at concordiatheology.org. Check it out. While you're there, you'll also find episodes of our other podcast, Tangible, Theology Learned and Lived. Twice a month, I host conversations with Concordia Seminary faculty. We talk about the ways in which their understanding of God and faith is real in their everyday lives. The show is for anyone who wants to deepen their theology. Tell your congregation about it. It's Tangible, Theology Learned and Lived. You can find episodes of Lectionary Kickstart and Tangible at any of the major podcast apps. If you'd like to see the show continue, please subscribe, share, and leave a review. I'm your host and producer, Jessica Bordalo. Join us here next week at Lectionary Kickstart when Dr. David Schmidt and Dr. Peter Nafsker will spark your thoughts for next Sunday.
And I was going to preach it, and then I was going to die.